When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Whispers from the Dark. The architecture of control. Are cities designed to shape human behavior? By Raven Vale. There's a moment that happens in every city. You don't notice it at first. It's subtle, almost imperceptible. It happens when you step off a train, or climb out of your car, or emerge from underground into open air. Something shifts inside you, not dramatically, not with a sound or a signal. It just shifts. Your pace changes. Your posture straightens. Shoulders back, chin up, jaw set. Your voice drops without thinking. Your eyes begin moving differently, scanning, cataloging, measuring distance. No one instructs you. No one hands you a pamphlet that says, "Behave this way here." No authority figure leans down and whispers in your ear. And yet, you obey. You obey something you cannot see, cannot name, and in most cases have never once stopped to think about. Because cities don't just house people. They shape them. They compress them into corridors and funnel them through intersections. They accelerate them through transit hubs and slow them in commercial zones. They quiet them in the shadow of towers. They direct them through every subtle angle, every calculated sightline, every deliberate placement of a bench, a barrier, a beam of light. Tonight, we are not talking about occult symbols carved into marble floors. We are not talking about hidden sigils embedded in street maps or secret societies sketching blueprints by candlelight. We are talking about something far more unsettling than any of that. Because it's real, it's measurable, and it is operating on you right now. Street grids, glass towers, lighting temperature, bench placement, sight lines, the deliberate geometry of public space. Invisible influence, delivered through brick and steel and concrete. Psychological architecture. Because here is the question that keeps me up at night. Are cities designed for convenience, or are they designed for control? Welcome. This is Whispers from the Dark. The feeling of a place. Think about the financial district of New York City at dawn. Not at noon, crowded and loud. At dawn, before the rush. The streets are narrow corridors of steel and glass. Towers rise vertically, sheer and reflective. The sky is visible only in thin rectangular strips, framed by architecture, as though the city itself decided how much of the open world you're allowed to see. Even in summer, the air in those canyons feels colder. Wind channels between buildings, accelerated by the geometry of the space. Sound becomes clipped and functional. You walk faster there. Almost everyone does. Even tourists with nowhere to be. The environment overrides intention. Your legs find a rhythm the street seems to demand. Shoulders tighten. Smiles disappear. Conversations shorten. Eyes stay forward. Now replace that image with the older districts of Barcelona, the Eixample, where urban planner Ildefons Cerdà deliberately cut the sharp corners off every city block, opening intersections so light could pour across streets from multiple directions at once. The streets breathe there, wide, open, generous. You breathe differently too. Movement slows without effort. Your gaze softens. Something in your body that had been clenched, something you didn't know was clenched, releases. Why? Because your nervous system reads space long before your conscious mind does. Long before cities, humans survived by reading terrain. Open spaces meant visibility. You could see the threat coming. You could plan. You could escape. Narrow passages meant vulnerability. You couldn't see what waited around the bend. Height meant dominance. Shadow meant threat. Your brain is ancient. Architecture speaks directly to it, not in language or logic, but in the primal grammar of space and light and exposure. Modern cities are not accidental. They are engineered ecosystems of movement, designed by professionals who study exactly how human beings respond to their physical environment. And movement determines behavior. What you do next is shaped, more than you realize, by where you are standing right now. Geometry and authority. Look closely at the financial centers of the world's great cities. London's Canary Wharf, Lower Manhattan, La Défense in Paris, Luzhazui in Shanghai. The lines are straight. Aggressively, almost morally straight. The facades are reflective. Glass and polished stone that shows you yourself while hiding what is behind it. You can see you. You cannot see them. The symmetry is rigid, deliberate, mathematically precise in a way that no natural environment ever is. And the vertical dominance is constant. Everything rises. Everything aspires upward. You are at the bottom of all of it. This is not accidental. Geometry communicates before words ever form. Sharp angles signal order. They say without saying, things are organized here. Deviate at your peril. Repetition signals predictability. Uniformity tells your threat detection systems that it knows what to expect. No surprises, stable ground. And lower uncertainty increases compliance. This is not conspiracy. It is environmental psychology. A legitimate, extensively studied field. Research has demonstrated that angular spaces evoke alertness and mild tension. Curved environments feel safer. The eye follows a curve without alarm. It follows a sharp corner with something closer to vigilance. So consider what it means that the places in our cities, governing finance, law, and authority, are almost universally built with towering vertical lines, mirrored surfaces, and rigid geometric repetition. They feel powerful. They are designed to feel powerful. And power reshapes posture, even in people who are just walking past. In high-ceilinged spaces, people report feeling smaller, more contemplative, more deferential. They make different decisions than they would in lower-ceilinged rooms. In enclosed spaces, people become task-oriented and detail-focused. They execute. Ceiling height alters cognition. Street width alters walking speed. Facade uniformity alters emotional neutrality. These are measurable, reproducible effects. Cities are behavioral instruments, not because of hidden agendas, but because space changes people. And the people who design space have known this for a very long time. The maze effect. drive past the downtown core, past the older grid neighborhoods. Keep going until you reach the suburbs built in the last 40 or 50 years. Look at the roads. They wind. They curve around gentle bends without apparent reason. They loop back on themselves. They terminate in cul-de-sacs, circular dead ends that go nowhere by design. From above, these neighborhoods look like labyrinths, organic, irregular, and completely resistant to the logic of the grid. Urban planners will tell you it was about safety. Winding roads reduce cut-through traffic, slower cars, quieter streets, and that is true as far as it goes. But winding layouts do something else, something rarely mentioned in the official justifications. They limit permeability. If you don't know the neighborhood, if you don't live there, navigation becomes genuinely difficult. There are no straight lines to orient by, no grid to intuit. You get confused. You circle back. You find yourself in a cul-de-sac with no memory of how you got there. The design creates a powerful sense of territorial boundary. Controlled entry, controlled exit. If you don't live there, you feel it immediately. You feel like an outsider. The space produces that feeling through its physical structure alone. Non-linear design discourages wandering. It discourages strangers from drifting through. It encourages retreat, the slow, confused retreat of someone who doesn't belong and has been made, by geometry alone, to feel that truth. Urban grids, on the other hand, invite flow. The straight line is democratic. It says, pass through. You are welcome here. But grids also allow surveillance. A straight road can be watched from one end to the other, patrolled efficiently, monitored with minimum resources, which brings us to something far older than any modern city. The Panoptic City. In the late 18th century, the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham proposed a design for an ideal prison. He called it the Panopticon, a circular building, cells arranged around the entire perimeter, each one open to the interior, and at the center, a tall, enclosed watchtower. From that tower, a single guard could theoretically observe every prisoner simultaneously. But here was the true genius of the design, and the source of its horror. The prisoners could not see into the tower. They couldn't know whether the guard was watching at any given moment, whether anyone was watching, whether the tower was even occupied. But they could always be seen, or at least, they believed they could. And that belief was enough. Bentham understood something profound. You do not need to actually surveil people to change their behavior. You only need them to believe they might be observed at any moment. The architecture of visibility is sufficient. The structure does the work. Behavior adjusts automatically, internally, without coercion. Now fast forward 200 years. Open plazas with clear sight lines in every direction. Camera poles rising at regular intervals along every major street. Glass-fronted buildings with transparent lobbies. You can see in, but you cannot see who is watching from inside. Elevated highways passing directly over residential neighborhoods, granting a moving gallery of observers a regular view into private space. The point is not that cities are prisons. The point is that visibility alters behavior, and cities are saturated with designed visibility, engineered into their infrastructure at every level. Research consistently demonstrates that even symbolic cues of being watched increase compliance. An image of eyes near a payment box increases donations. A photograph of a face above a bicycle rack reduces theft. The suggestion of observation, with no actual observer present, changes what people do. Cities are filled with sight lines, long avenues that allow visual monitoring over great distances, strategic lighting designed to eliminate shadow, reflective glass that conceals the watcher while fully exposing the watched. None of this is secret. It is simply how security design evolved across centuries of human settlement. But the cumulative effect, when you finally see it all at once, is profound. We behave differently when we feel visible. We self-regulate. We internalize the watcher. We become, in Bentham's framework, our own guards. And we do not even notice we have accepted the position. Light is emotion. There is a tool in architecture so powerful, so immediate in its effect on the human body, that it is studied by neuroscientists, behavioral psychologists, retail strategists, and military planners, each for their own very different reasons. That tool is light, not just its presence or absence, the quality of it, the temperature, the angle, the intensity, the color, the rhythm of shadow it creates. Warm light evokes comfort. Something in the amber and golden tones of firelight, of candlelight, of late afternoon sun reaches past the thinking brain and lands directly in the emotional body. Warmth signals safety. Warmth signals home. Cool blue light increases alertness. It is no accident that the screens we stare at before sleep emit blue spectrum light. That specific wavelength tells the brain it is daytime, that there is work to be done. Operating rooms are cool and bright. Police interrogation rooms are cool and bright. The effect is not subtle. Bright, high-intensity lighting increases arousal. Your attention sharpens. Decision-making accelerates. Dim lighting increases intimacy. It narrows perceived space, softens the boundaries between people, and lowers the social inhibitions that operate like armor in fully lit public environments. Now consider how cities deploy these effects, deliberately, at scale. Financial districts use cooler lighting tones along their major streets. The physiological message: this is not a place for rest, this is a place for work. Transit hubs are almost universally bright and white. High intensity, cool spectrum, no shadows. You are meant to be in motion, not at rest, and the light communicates that before any signage does. Upscale residential and commercial corridors use warmer hues. The message is wealth, comfort, desirability. You should feel, walking these streets, that you have arrived somewhere worth arriving. Public housing projects throughout the 20th century historically used harsh, uniform, fluorescent lighting. Efficient, inexpensive, emotionally inert. Not coincidentally, it was also the option that communicated austerity most effectively. Lighting shapes mood, mood shapes decision making. Consider the bodily difference between walking under old sodium vapor streetlights, that orange-yellow glow that makes everything look slightly unreal, versus soft amber bulbs that mimic interior warmth. Your body reacts. Heart rate shifts. Muscle tension changes. Breathing pace adjusts. Cities choose their light, and that choice influences the emotional state of every person who moves through that space, at every hour, in every season, year after year. That is influence at an extraordinary scale, and most of us never think about it for a single moment. crowd psychology and flow. Human beings move in patterns. Architects and urban planners have been studying this with increasing sophistication for the better part of a century, where bottlenecks form, where crowds naturally gather, where hesitation begins, that subtle faltering of movement that happens when a space sends a conflicting signal about what to do next. Retail corridors are designed to slow you down. This is not an inference. It is an explicit design intention. Corridors curve gently, so you cannot see what is coming, keeping you engaged rather than assessing from a distance and moving on. Lighting makes products look appealing. Music is selected by tempo and emotional tone to influence how quickly you move and how long you stay. Every element of the environment is working, simultaneously and invisibly, to keep you in the space longer than you intended. Airports are designed to move you efficiently, but efficiently in a specific direction, past a specific sequence of commercial opportunities. The path from security to gate almost always leads through a carefully curated corridor of shops and restaurants. They are not there because the shops happen to be there. The shops are there because the architecture ensures every passenger walks past them. The building creates the customer. Public squares encourage or discourage assembly based on their design. A square with open space and comfortable seating invites gathering. A square with broken pavement, no seating, and poor lighting empties itself. The politics of assembly are built into the concrete. Narrow sidewalks increase pedestrian tension. When the margins of personal space are constantly violated by sheer proximity, stress rises. Interactions become guarded. The character of the street shifts. Wide promenades increase leisure. Space gives permission. When there is room, people slow down, drift, stop to talk. The street becomes social rather than transactional. Behavioral engineering at this scale requires no conspiracy. It requires only observation. Watch how people actually move, what makes them slow or hurry, what causes them to spend money or gather or disperse, and then design for the outcomes you want. Cities have done exactly this across time, across cultures, across economic systems. Financial centers optimize for productivity. Residential zones optimize for privacy. Commercial zones optimize for spending. Government zones optimize for order. Is that sinister? Or simply practical? The unsettling part is not the intent behind any of these choices. It is the invisibility of them. Most people moving through designed environments never register that the environment is working on them. They attribute their behavior to themselves. They think they walked faster because they were in a hurry. They think they spent more because the product appealed to them. But the space shaped the behavior, and the space was built to shape it. The emotional temperature of a city. Every city has a feeling, not just a reputation or a cultural identity built by tourism boards. A genuine, physiological, emotional climate that its built environment generates in the bodies of the people who inhabit it. Tokyo feels hyper-efficient. The infrastructure is dense and precise and moves with clockwork reliability. The architecture tends towards the clean and vertical. Public space is maintained with extraordinary care. The expectation of order is embedded in every surface. Paris feels romantic, not because French people are inherently more romantic, but because the built environment of the historic city center operates on a human scale most modern cities have abandoned. 5 or 6 story buildings, not 40. Streets that are neither oppressively narrow nor so wide they dwarf the individual. parks that are lush and geometrically intentional. Chicago feels structured and industrial. The grid is aggressive. The architecture is serious. The city makes no apology for its origins in trade and raw ambition. These are not accidents of character. They are the cumulative result of thousands of design decisions about materials, scale, and the relationship between buildings and street and sky. Material choices communicate. Glass reflects. It shows you yourself while concealing what is behind it. Stone absorbs. It takes light and holds it. It says, "I have been here before you. I will be here after you." Steel signals permanence and industrial seriousness. Concrete signals austerity. Brutalist architecture, much criticized, much misunderstood, was designed to communicate democratic honesty. What it communicated to the people who actually used those buildings was often something closer to oppression. Intention and effect diverged dramatically. Tree cover lowers aggression. Multiple longitudinal studies across different cities, demographics, and cultures have demonstrated that neighborhoods with more tree canopy report lower rates of violent crime, lower stress, improved mental health outcomes, and stronger social cohesion. Nature regulates the human stress response at a biological level. Remove it, replace it with concrete and glass, and cortisol rises. Tempers shorten. The ambient tension of daily life increases. Add it back. Trees along a sidewalk, a small park within walking distance, and the data changes. The body relaxes in ways it cannot replicate indoors or in fully paved environments. Cities calibrate this balance constantly, whether or not they articulate it in those terms. The question this raises, one I don't think has a clean answer, is whether emotional regulation through architectural choice is ethical or inevitable, or whether, perhaps uncomfortably, it is both. Defensive design. Have you ever sat on a public bench and noticed, midway through sitting, that there is an armrest placed not at the end, but directly in the center? Not for comfort. An armrest placed precisely where someone might otherwise lie down. Have you noticed the metal spikes under the overhangs of bridges, along the windowsills of buildings, on the flat ledges above ground floor storefronts? Have you noticed the sloped concrete surfaces where flat ground would naturally invite someone to rest? This is called hostile architecture. It discourages certain behaviors without making any announcement. It discourages sleeping in public. It discourages loitering. That vague, contested activity that means different things depending on who is doing it and who is watching. It discourages the kind of extended stationary presence that makes certain groups of people visible in spaces where they are not considered welcome. It is not hidden. Architects and urban designers debate it openly. It appears in academic journals, professional publications, and city planning documents. It has critics who call it an expression of urban cruelty, and defenders who call it a matter of maintenance and safety. The proponents argue practicality. Shared infrastructure needs to function. A bench no one sleeps on lasts longer. The critics argue morality. These designs don't solve the problems that cause people to sleep in public. They move those problems, and those people, somewhere less visible. They redesign public space to exclude specific populations without passing a law or posting a sign. Architecture enforces rules without speaking. It shapes who feels welcome in a given space and who does not, who belongs, and who is politely but unmistakably ejected by the physical environment itself. and it does this silently, without the friction of confrontation, without the cost of enforcement, without the political visibility of an explicitly exclusionary policy. The architecture just is, and its effects simply accumulate. Modern minimalism and the human mind. Modern architecture, particularly in commercial and corporate contexts, has converged on a powerful aesthetic. Flat surfaces, monochrome palettes, white, grey, black, the occasional muted earth tone, clean lines, uninterrupted by ornament or texture, or anything that might be considered decorative, glass walls, open floor plans, the deliberate suppression of visual complexity in favor of aspirational blankness. This aesthetic communicates efficiency. It says, we have moved past the clutter of the past. We function in clarity now. But growing evidence from cognitive science suggests that this clarity has a cost. The human brain evolved in environments of extraordinary visual richness. The natural world, the world in which our nervous systems were shaped across hundreds of thousands of years, is dense with texture, variation, and fractal complexity at every scale. When you walk through a forest, your brain processes an immense and continuous stream of varied information. And critically, it does so with ease. Natural environments restore attentional resources rather than depleting them. When surrounded by flat, artificial, monochrome planes, when there is nothing for the pattern recognition systems of the brain to engage with, something called directed attention, fatigue begins to develop. The brain works harder, paradoxically, in the presence of less visual information, because it must continually suppress the urge to seek stimulation the environment doesn't provide. This may explain something anyone who has spent time in both types of environment has felt without being able to name. Why older neighborhoods with irregular facades, varied materials, and layers of accumulated visual history feel more alive, more interesting, more human. They stimulate pattern recognition. They give the brain something to do. Modern districts suppress visual complexity, and the experience, when you pay attention, can feel subtly draining, clean and impressive, and just, somehow, slightly wrong. Uniformity reduces distraction. Reduced distraction increases focus. Focus increases productivity. Productivity benefits the systems, commercial, corporate, economic, that most modern architecture is ultimately designed to serve. Is that control or optimization? Perhaps in this case, more than most, the answer is both, the invisible agreement. Here is the uncomfortable truth at the center of everything we've been discussing tonight. Every time you move through a city, every commute, every errand, every walk without a destination, you are participating in a silent agreement. You didn't sign it. You weren't asked. It was waiting for you when you arrived, embedded in the pavement, and the building faces, and the traffic signals, and the invisible geometry of every public space you've ever moved through. You accept the flow. You join the current of bodies moving in prescribed directions, through prescribed corridors, at the pace the environment has decided is appropriate. You obey the light signals. Red, green, walk, wait. You do this thousands of times across the course of a life without ever experiencing it as obedience, though obedience is precisely what it is. You walk where the pavement directs. You stop where barriers guide. You gather where space invites. You disperse where design makes gathering uncomfortable. No one forces you. The design does. the city becomes a choreography of compliance, a vast and continuous performance in which millions of people move in coordinated patterns they experience as freely chosen, without ever recognizing the choreographer. But compliance is not inherently evil. Traffic lights prevent the chaos that would result from millions of vehicles attempting to navigate intersections by negotiation alone. The alternative to that compliance is not freedom. It is gridlock and collapse. Zoning prevents overcrowding and incompatible land use that historically made cities dangerous and unlivable. Structure allows tens of millions of strangers to coexist in close proximity without descending into collapse. That is not a trivial achievement. The darker question, the one worth sitting with, is not whether cities shape behavior. They clearly do. The question is, who decides the shape? Developers, whose primary obligation is to their investors, and not to the people who will live in what they build. Governments, operating within political pressures and electoral timelines that may have nothing to do with long-term urban flourishing. Security experts, professionally trained to optimize for threat prevention, who may be temperamentally inclined toward designs that prioritize control over comfort. And perhaps most importantly, how transparent are those decisions? How many people walking through a city designed to guide their emotions and movements have ever had any input into that design? How many were even told? Emergence or intention? It is tempting to imagine a hidden master plan, a room, a table, people with blueprints and long-term intentions, and the patience to implement a vision across decades. Control by design, literally. But the reality of how cities get built is, in some ways, even more unsettling than that. Because at least a master plan would have an author. At least you could, in principle, find the room and confront the people in it. Cities are almost never the product of a single will. They are layered, accumulated, the result of thousands of decisions made by thousands of different actors across decades, each responding to circumstances and incentives that may have had nothing to do with behavioral control. An economic pressure shifts where investment flows, and a neighborhood's character changes without any individual having chosen to change it. A political policy, a zoning change, a transportation investment, a decision about where to place public housing, reshapes the geography of daily life for entire populations without anyone explicitly designing that reshaping. Cultural taste evolves and architecture follows, reflecting a society's values about efficiency and beauty. And who deserves what kind of space? Security concerns, particularly in the decades since the early 2000s, have layered designed visibility and controlled access onto urban environments in ways that have permanently altered what it feels like to move through a city. All of these forces interact. They push against each other and produce effects no single participant intended or fully foresaw. What feels like control may often be emergent design, the unplanned result of countless planned decisions, each innocent on its own, collectively forming something that functions exactly like intention. And yet the effect remains the same. Cities influence emotion, they influence movement, they influence thought, subtly, continuously. Unavoidably. You cannot opt out of your physical environment while you remain within it. You can be aware of it. You can study it and talk about it at night like this. But you cannot stop your nervous system from responding. The influence operates below awareness. That is what makes it worth talking about. The Future of Behavioral Architecture. Now consider the next iteration of all of this. The smart city. Sensors embedded in roads and sidewalks and buildings, collecting real-time data on pedestrian flow, dwell time, and behavioral patterns. Adaptive lighting systems that shift color temperature and intensity based on foot traffic and crime statistics. Surveillance analytics that don't just record but interpret. Systems that flag unusual behavior, track individuals across multiple camera feeds, and generate probability assessments about what is about to happen in a given location. Crowd prediction algorithms that model population behavior based on historical data and allow planners and security agencies to preemptively reshape the environment before events unfold. Urban planners can now model the emotional and behavioral impact of a building before it is constructed. They can run simulations of pedestrian flow through a proposed plaza and identify, before a single foundation is poured, where people will gather, where they will hesitate, where crime is statistically likely to occur. Architecture is no longer purely static. It is becoming responsive, dynamic, adaptive. The city can sense, and the city can adjust. The tools for shaping behavior are becoming more precise. Not more powerful. Cities have always had power over the people who live in them. More precise. More capable of acting, not just on populations in general, but on specific people in specific moments. This can, as proponents correctly argue, increase public safety. It can reduce crime. It can optimize transportation. The beneficial applications are real, but it also centralizes influence in new and significant ways. When algorithms shape physical space, when the lighting on a street corner changes in response to a machine learning recommendation, based on last month's police reports, the chain of decisions becomes very long and very opaque. Who trained the model? On what data? With what biases built in? Who is accountable when the algorithm gets it wrong? When invisible hands multiply, it becomes increasingly difficult to find any single hand to hold responsible. The city whispers. The algorithm listens, and then the city adjusts its whisper accordingly. The quiet power of space. I want to be clear about something before we close. There is no secret cabal in this episode. No hidden symbol carved into the foundation of City Hall. No whispered oath in a candlelit chamber beneath an old bank building. The unsettling truth is simpler and harder to resist than any conspiracy. Space changes people. Design changes mood. Mood changes action. Action shapes society. And most of us move through this architecture every single day without ever realizing it is shaping us, without registering that the pace of our walk, the tension in our jaw, the particular unease that settles over us in certain neighborhoods is not a product of our inner life, but a response to the built environment around us. When you enter a towering glass atrium and lower your voice, even though no one asked you to, you are responding to design. When you step into a narrow alley and feel your pace quicken and your shoulders rise, you are responding to design. When you find a bench in a park, beneath old trees, and feel something in you slow down and release, you are responding to design. Cities are not neutral containers. They are active emotional landscapes, built by human hands according to human intentions, economic, political, aesthetic, and security intentions, all layered on top of each other until the original intent is difficult to identify. But the effect is undeniable, and they are built by people, which means they could, in principle, be built differently, more consciously, more honestly, with more transparency about the effects that design produces, and more genuine public input into what those effects should be. Some architects and urban planners are already working in exactly this direction, designing explicitly for psychological well-being, studying which built environments produce flourishing and which produce distress, and applying that knowledge in service of populations rather than systems. It begins with noticing. Next time you walk through your city, I want you to try something. Don't walk faster than you need to. Don't tune out what's around you. Notice your shoulders. Are they tight or easy? When did they shift? And what were you walking past when they did? Notice your breathing. Is it full and deep, or shallow and quick? Notice your speed. Are you moving at the pace you chose when you left home? Or has the environment quietly negotiated you into something different? Ask yourself, with as much honesty as you can manage, is this how I would move if I were standing in an open field with no buildings in any direction? Or am I being guided? Not forced, not commanded, guided. Through geometry and light and sight lines and silence. Through the angle of a street and the temperature of a lamp and the placement of a bench that is just slightly, deliberately, almost imperceptibly uncomfortable. Cities do not need chains to influence you. They use glass, they use steel. They use the ancient wiring of a brain that evolved on open ground and still responds viscerally to everything that space tells it. The architecture of control is not loud. It does not shout. It whispers. And once you hear it, you cannot unhear it. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale. And the next time the city changes how you feel, changes your posture, your pace, the feeling in your chest when you turn a particular corner. Listen closely. It may not be speaking in words, but it is speaking.